I think
This
I got
call
it.
is being recorded by the meeting organizer.
Great.
By staying on the call, you are giving your consent to being recorded.
Okay, so keep that in mind when you guys are asking me questions. You're being recorded. And I'm happy too, if you have a question that you want to ask me off the call for various reasons, just keep in mind we are recording it. It will go on our website. It will be... But if you have a question you want to ask me that is not subject to those conditions, you're welcome to email me. You're welcome to call me. I know a lot of you guys already email me questions. I'll tell you, and let me just introduce myself to those of you who don't know me. I've been with the Guardian Ad Litem program since I was in law school. I was, you know, a volunteer, and then continued to be a volunteer when I worked as a public defender in Tallahassee. And I'm back with Donnie and some of us, you know, we joke what we're like the cockroaches of the Guardian Ad Litem program. We're still crawling around after all the bombs have gone off. But we were, you know, been with the program back since when we worked under the judges. I was a supervising attorney. I covered in the Second Circuit where I covered 5 counties. So things have really, and I was in court almost every day in different counties, so it was a lot of fun, but we've really come a long way since then. I've been a supervising attorney in the Gainesville office, and then I've been with the state office now for basically since the state office began. I've worked in some capacity helping with the state office with various things. About 10 years ago, I started my own adoption practice. And I have been doing that in addition to helping with guardian ad litem work. I also do now, through my private practice, I also do a lot of guardianships and some elder law. So if you guys have any questions in any of those areas, more than happy to always be a resource for you. Please email me. I know, and some of you guys, I'm on a lot of, you know, I use me a lot more than other areas, but please, again, I'm happy to help however I can, because a lot of times, especially with adoption issues or guardianship issues, it could take you guys a long time to find out an answer to something that I might know, and I'm not promising I will, but I might know it off the top of my head, and it can just save you a bunch of time. So I'm always happy to help however I can. So having said that, Kelly asked, or Donnie actually, Donnie and I, we had some unusual subsidy issues, I think, come up, and a couple of months ago we decided it would be a good idea to go ahead and do a call on subsidy. And what I want to do is just go over what the law is with you, and then open it up to questions. So hopefully you guys will have questions, or if you don't today, that's fine. I understand with this kind of thing, sometimes it's hard to anticipate the questions. So you may have a case that comes up in the future and you need to follow up, and that's, of course, again, fine. So I want to tell you, though, that the operating procedures are going to change. The department is in the process of drafting those. It's been in the works for a very long time. And who knows, I asked my contact in Tallahassee that works with subsidy, I asked when this, I just called her before this call to find out when we might expect those changes to be in effect, and she said she has no idea. It could be a month, it could be a year. But the good news, in a sense, in terms of the new operating procedures is that there's not going to be any huge changes. The biggest change is going to be with the medical subsidy. The medical subsidy, it sounds like, is going to be improved significantly, which means that there's going to be a one-time needs-specific subsidy that could be available. There's going to be a more enhanced subsidy, greater amount in that monthly amount that the family receives based on medical needs of the child. So that's been a big problem in terms of subsidy, in terms of a missing piece. Everyone's hopeful that that's going to make a difference in those lives of those children who really need the enhanced subsidy the most. I think you guys all know this, but just to go over very generally what subsidy is. And you would be surprised, well, no, you guys wouldn't be, because I know you guys are all in the trenches every day, but I am still amazed that when families, when adoptive families contact me and they don't really understand subsidy because the caseworker has not really explained it to them. So you guys and your volunteers may have to explain what subsidy is in a way that families can understand. So it is, the monthly stipend, and we're going to get into that's the most, the trickiest piece in terms of what exactly that amount would be. So the monthly stipend, and that varies district by district. Each district has designated an amount. In my area, I'm in North Central Florida. It's about, I think it's like $351 now a month. So there is this monthly, and a lot of people think that the monthly payment, that's subsidy. But it's actually more than that. It's also Medicaid until the child is 18. It's also 4 years of college tuition and that can be, it's a public school in Florida. So it has to be in Florida, has to be a public school, but it can be any type of public higher education institution. So, of course, community colleges, a lot of community colleges have trade schools or have, branch off institutions where youth can develop a trade. So any of those types of educational institutions apply for subsidy. A lot of people, so how it works is they give the family a letter with the subsidy information. A lot of people get worried, if they I lost that form, so I don't get subsidy. And that's not how it works. How it works is the child's registered with when the child is, designated to get subsidy, the child gets registered with the financial aid folks that manage financial aid for for the state. And then it'll automatically pop up for the child. They apply for financial aid, and then they just get full financial aid. Keep in mind, a lot of these kids also will be eligible for Pell grants, and those are a significant amount of money as well. So it can really be, that's potentially the biggest value in subsidy is that 4 years of tuition someplace. Depending, of course, how old the child is when they're adopted. If it's an infant, then that monthly subsidy, will, of course, that adds up over the years. And then the last piece that's included just generally is the paying for the adoption. So the statute allows for up to $1,000 to be paid for the legal fees for the adoption. Now, that includes the filing fees and the costs, which are in most circuits $400, some places they're $300, some places they're $450. So then the attorney is paid the remainder of that. Now, I know in some parts of the state that, especially in the more urban areas, the legal fees are attorneys bill higher, and that is not, considering potentially sometimes the more work is required in those bigger circuits because it can be more difficult to get cases on the docket and things like that. So the quality of the representation may not be great because it's such a small amount of money that's paid. But, one idea I've heard, and I haven't done it myself, but I in some of these areas I've heard attorneys talk about filing, if the family's eligible, filing a fee waiver for the filing fee. Because if the family, we have a lot of adoptions in the system that are family members and we see a lot of grandmas and grannies and great grandmas and folks that don't have any income that certainly would qualify as indigent. So that's one idea just to keep in mind. There's nothing that stops someone from, and I've suggested it in a few of our cases where we've been filing the petition that the petitioner look at filing as an indigent with indigent status so that they can get that cost waived because that's a big cost. And I honestly don't know, though. I haven't heard from anyone that it's a problem finding attorneys to do the adoptions. I mean, typically, most of us are very happy to do it, even for, it's significantly reduced than what we would be paid for a private adoption just because of the work is so important, and we're happy to do it. But if you guys are in those bigger cities where that's becoming a problem, let me know, and I'm happy to maybe help you guys think of you know, do that indigency piece. Okay, so the two, there's a statute and then there's a rule, an administrative rule that governs subsidy. So the statute, and again, I'm going to send you the link for this. You don't need to write this down, but it's 409.166. And it has been in effect since, I mean, they changed it in, I believe it was 2007. I'm looking at the amendments. They've made some small changes over the years, but it's basically stayed the same for the most part over the years. Not much has changed. They do, in the first part of the statute, they define special needs. And I want to go over that because it's a bit, for people outside of the system, it's an interesting definition. It's not necessarily what people would think of the definition special needs, and I think it's important, especially as we're trying to encourage just generally foster care adoption, that folks understand that what special needs means in this context. It does not mean that the child has necessarily a disability. So the requirements under the statute is that the child, that permanent custody of the child has been given to DCF or to another agency. You know, I know some of the consents in some areas actually give custody to the CBC, but, you know, so the statute covers either of those scenarios. Then there are five different factors that can also that have to be met in order for the child to be deemed to have special needs. So if the child is 8 or older, if the child does have a developmental disability, if the child is physically or emotionally handicapped, if the child is black or racially mixed, if the child is a member of a sibling group. So you typically have to have one of those things for the child to be deemed to be special needs. However, most places also, the statute allows for subsidy where the child's, and this kind of goes back to, and it relates to, and I'm going to get into this when we talk about how to get an enhanced subsidy, but that the child has been exposed to alcohol, substance abuse, domestic violence, you know, all of those multiple risk factors, and that has an effect on the child's development. And that's how, and again, we'll get into this, how you get the enhanced subsidy. But so that's another way that children qualify for subsidy. And I, you know, it varies, I think, across the state. I mean, I know in my circuit, for example, they give subsidy to every child that's adopted through the dependency system. But I know in other areas of the state that it can be more of a battle. But I'm hoping for your sake that is the case. But I don't know, Kelly, you may have a better read on that than I do in terms of what's happening statewide. But given the broad parameters of what qualifies a child for subsidy, you know, we should be fighting to try and figure out a way to get them subsidy whenever we can. I'm reviewing the statute. I just want to make sure there's nothing else I should talk to you guys about. Okay, well, let's go ahead and talk about the maintenance subsidy. So, and what is allowed and what, you know, how that kind of practically works. So, you know, the first thing, of course, is that if the child is getting SSI or getting some other, is a recipient from some other entitlement program, then the subsidy, they adjust the monthly amount. So you don't get both, basically. So you offset it to get, you know, you still get the same amount that every other child is getting in your district for that monthly amount. But you're not going to get the Social Security payment and subsidy. So that's an important thing that a lot of families don't understand. I mean, the other biggie with subsidy is that, I mean, and it actually says this in the statute, that it cannot exceed the foster care maintenance payment, which would have been paid in the same time period if the child had been in a foster home. So, you know, that's where you get that ceiling. And the problem we have, and this is why you hear, you know, people complain that their funds are cut when they adopt, is that there are other pieces of support that the CDC provides pending the adoption that cannot be provided once the adoption finalizes. So you'll see where the CBC is paying for daycare, or you'll see, I know my CBC reimburses families for travel expenses. If they, I have a case where the child's medically needy and the family lives about 30 minutes from the hospital, and the CBC was paying, and the child literally was in the hospital 3 or 4 times a week, and they were, the CBC would pay for all that mileage. Well, that stops, you know, as soon as the child is adopted, which can be significant depending on the child's needs. The goal of hoping, you know, with those kinds of situations, that's why we have this new rule coming in terms of medical subsidy. So, it's medical assistance subsidy is what it's the full title of it. But the hope is that once we have that in place, that will be able to meet, you know, pick up the slack in that scenario that I gave you in terms of more medical needy child would have more needs. But, you know, so once a child is deemed eligible for subsidy, you know, they go in with getting the flat, that flat rate. So how does a family get more and can they get more? One thing, if you take anything from this call, the one thing I want you to take from this call is that subsidy has to be in place before the adoption finalizes. Now, in your traditional case, that's not going to be a problem because you guys are going to be, you know, the department's going to, the CBC is going to be handling the adoption. They don't even do the consent until subsidy is in place. But where it's trickier is in your interventions, where you're going to have a private attorney, and a lot of private attorneys don't know about subsidy. Children adopted through private adoptions are absolutely eligible for subsidy. Absolutely. I've done it several times. We've gotten even enhanced subsidy in private adoptions. But this is the thing. It has to be in place before the adoption finalizes. There actually is one, I know of at least one scenario where they were able to get subsidy in place after, but it was a huge nightmare. And I remember... It almost didn't happen. It was really complicated. So you need to, that's a biggie. If you're handing over a case to an intervention where the private adoption comes in, make sure, I mean, I would tell whoever you can, whoever will listen, get subsidy in place. Because a lot of the private attorneys don't know about it, or they're not going to want to do the work to get it in place. It's really, frankly, though, not that much work for the attorney. It's work for the CBC. Every CBC has a subsidy employee or a committee that handles subsidy for the CBC. They have to do, there's just a bunch of paperwork basically that they do and the family does. So, but you've got to get that in place before you finalize the adoption. The other thing, the other, you know, issue to this is how do you get more if you have a child that has you know, extra needs. So, and I've had people tell me that their CBC has said, we've never given an enhanced subsidy. So I know that that is the practice in some areas of the state, but I can assure you that in other areas of the state, we see enhanced subsidy all the time. I know, and it's not just in my circuit. I know it's been years, but I remember helping Donnie and his team did a great job in the Seventh Circuit getting an enhanced subsidy for a child that had fetal alcohol, where, you know, so the problem is that you can only get the enhanced rate if you can show that the services needed are not covered by Medicaid. So you can't just say to the department, we need an extra $5,000 a year, or we need an extra $500 a month, or whatever, you know, you're asking, because the child has special needs. That's not going to cut it. What you have to do, and I've done this many times for families, and the way it works best is you have to have actual invoices, letters. You need to have proof from providers as to what the services cost and that they're not covered by Medicaid. So in Donnie's case, I remember we had a therapist who gave us a recommendation that said the child needs to have needs to do dance classes because that will help with her symptoms or things, you know, the issues she was having because of the fetal alcohol, they could be minimized by participating in dance classes, which of course are not covered by Medicaid. So we were able to, with that letter, and then the Guardian got, you know, information from various dance studios to show what the fair market value of dance classes are. You know, we were able to get an enhanced rate based on getting that, getting the dance classes, you know, showing what the dance classes would cost and getting more in subsidy on that basis. I've been able to do it where a child had severe dental issues because of malnutrition. Because she, through the course of her abuse, abandonment, or neglect, she, you know, no one had taken care of her teeth for many years. And she had to have massive, she required, you know, not just braces, but massive orthodontic care. And we were able, we had to get, you know, a letter, we had to get an opinion of an orthodontist. They had to exactly detail what the, it was anticipated would be needed, what the cost would be. So we, you know, and someone doesn't have their phone on mute. I hope you guys can everyone hear me okay?
Yes.
Yes. I've been doing these calls forever, and I don't get that. Like, if you don't want to listen to the call, just hang up. Don't have your phone on speakerphone and have another conversation. But anyways, back to, you have to have that proof. And don't be shy. There's no harm in asking. You know, there's this pressure on the families to finalize, and a lot of the families will want to finalize the adoption. So they're going to be resistant to going in and asking for those, you know, for the enhanced subsidy. But, you know, it's much easier to get it the enhanced rate before the adoption finalizes. Now, having said that, you technically can always come back and get an enhanced rate. So even after, you know, you have to get, just to be clear, you have to get subsidy in place. So if you don't have subsidy in place before the adoption finalizes, then you've got big problems. But if you get subsidy in place and then you discover in 5 years that the child needs this orthodontic care, you can go back and apply for the enhanced subsidy. It's a pain, and it's a lot of work for the family to do that. It's much better to get it up front if you can. But things come up and that you can't anticipate. So it's important for families to know that as well, that if things, you know, if the child develops something in the future, the door is not shut on getting subsidy, getting an increase in the future. And what happens in terms of, at least, and I think each CDC handles this differently, but there's, you know, a group of folks who review everything that you've submitted, and they'll verify. I mean, they may even talk to the providers. You know, they'll verify whatever the whatever's been provided, and then for them to give you that increase, of course, they have to jump through a bunch of hoops, and they have to have, the secretary's designated people. The rule or the statute says that the secretary has to sign off at any subsidy that's when it's higher than the the foster care board rate, which an enhanced subsidy is going to be most likely. The statute says the secretary has to do that, but actually there's someone that the secretary has designated different people in each region that do that. But they do that all the time. So there's no harm in asking. It can't get lower. So the family doesn't have to risk, you know, being worried if they're, you know, what if we ask? Can they do something to affect our subsidy generally? And no. I mean, the base is going to be that monthly subsidy amount that's the same for everyone in your district. So there's really no harm in trying to get that enhanced rate, and I would encourage families to do it before they finalize versus waiting till after, because, again, I've done it both ways, and it's much easier and quicker to do it before. Because, keep in mind, you have that incentive, too, of the agency wanting the adoption to finalize. They want to get their numbers for the quarter or the year or whatever, so there's an incentive there for them to process it quicker. Whereas after the adoption finalizes, that incentive is gone. So, you know, I always recommend that you try and get that resolved before. Okay, let me just look through see what else we've got here. So So the statute's not very long, so I would encourage you to just read through it, you know, if you have a subsidy issue. And then I want to talk just for a minute about the administrative code. So the administrative code is, you know, has some information in it that's similar to the statute. One thing I forgot to mention in terms of getting an enhanced subsidy, the reason for the enhancement has to relate to the reason the child is dependent, you know, or has been, you know, was deemed to be dependent. So you've got to have, you know, so you can't need an enhanced, you won't get enhanced subsidy if the child, let's say, falls down and, you know, does something to their face and needs elective, you know, orthodontic care, or, you know, so you won't be able to get an enhanced subsidy for that. But you have to show somehow whatever the enhancement that you're asking for relates back to the child's, why the child is in care. So, you know, back to the fetal alcohol child, I mean, that is an easy connection because she was exposed to alcohol, you know, in the womb, and, you know, so that's an obvious one. But you can have it, like, you know, again, most of the children have been neglected in some way. You may have to do a little, you know, and have your volunteer do a little casework, looking back through the files, trying to find, you know, figuring out what the child's issues are, talking to the therapist to find out what they think, you know, where this is coming from, or, you know, you're going to have to get some expert opinion in there somewhere in terms of what, you know, whatever the issue is, how it relates to the dependency. But you usually should be able, for most of the time, be able to make that causal connection, but you do have to have that. And this is silly, but, and I'm sure you guys all know this, but you can't get it for things that are more like wish lists, like, well, this child just loves going to Disney World, and so we want to get more so the child can go to Disney once a year, or some, you know, stuff like that. I know that sounds crazy, but the volunteers, you know how some of them really have very high hopes and dreams for the child, so you have to kind of sometimes back it down for them in terms of, I mean, it's only intended for special needs that cannot be covered by Medicaid. The other issue I see a lot is that folks don't like the Medicaid providers, so they want to use someone else. That's a problem. That's hard. I mean, so to do that, you have to find someone. You're going to have to find a therapist or whoever it is that you want to use that's not a Medicaid provider. They're going to have be able to distinguish for you why their service is different than what the Medicaid provider can provide. So, and we've done that before. I had a child that was in therapy for her whole life with a provider who stopped taking Medicaid. And so, but we were able to, you know, we got a great letter from the therapist who explained how important, you know, she had become in the child's life. I mean, she literally had given her therapy for 3 or 4 years. Like, she was the one constant in the child's life. And we were able to get enhanced subsidy to cover that. You know, one of the things that is interesting with subsidy is that the statute says that it can, you know, it can always go away. It never has. And the other thing, and it can always go up or down, but it never, at least I have never heard of it going down. So once you, and you know, that's maybe not a great thing in the sense of, like, if we're paying, we might still be paying for ballet lessons for that child, the fetal alcohol child, when she, you know, hasn't done dance in 3 years. I don't know a good solution to that because we really don't have a way to, of course, we're not so involved in the Chick family's lives, and I don't want to suggest that we be, but at the same time, you can see, you know, how potentially there might be higher subsidies in for children that maybe don't need it anymore. But it doesn't ever, I've never, it technically can go down, but it the practicality of it is it does not. Okay, let me just see. Looking at the code provision, it's 65C dash, and then it's 16.012. It's just in the part of the code that I'm sure you guys are familiar with that talks about adoption. So it's where, you know, the discussion of match staffings and all of that are. Talks about, again, it's repetitive of the statute in terms of, you know, that the adoption expenses such as the attorney's fees are reimbursable. That's where you see the language of the tuition waiver is in the administrative code. It says that it's Florida universities or community colleges. It also then says that the CDC must inform the parent of the tax credit, which is interesting to me because I would say a quarter of my families have any clue about the tax credit when they get to me. So that's something they're definitely not learning about. The tax credit is, and I'll send you guys, let me make a note to remind myself, I'll send you that form as well. It's not complicated. It used to be that for 2 years, it was an actual refund. So you may have heard, you guys, for those of you who have been doing this for a while, you may remember when families got a check, regardless of whether or not they paid taxes, they would get the full amount. That is not the case anymore. Now it's a credit. So, and there are a couple of things about the tax credit that I want to tell you guys. And the first is that the amount, you know, it's about $13,500 now. It goes up a little bit every year to adjust for the you know, cost of living increases. It is a credit, so that means that they have to owe that in taxes. So a lot of our grannies and our, you know, our older adoptive parents that don't work, they aren't going to be able to use it. So you have to, you know, again, you have to use it as a credit. You do have 5 years to use it, though. So I always recommend with my working families, if they change their withholding, they need to meet with an accountant, figure out how to change their withholding so that they actually owe taxes every year and are able to use it. The one thing that's tricky, and I get a call, I probably get 10 calls every January from clients of adoptions I've done that year where they're at their CPA's office, or it's, and it's not usually a CPA, it's usually when they're at one of those mass tax places for the, you know, the Statue of Liberty's out waving people in. They're saying, well, I don't get the, they said I only get my actual expenses, I don't get the full amount of the tax credit. That is wrong. That only applies in private adoptions. For children adopted through the dependency system, they're considered special needs, and they get the full amount of the credit regardless of their cost or their expenses. And what the family needs to do, I give the form, and I'm going to give it to you guys. Their adoption attorneys hopefully are doing this, but all they need to send in with the, there's a very simple form they can fill out that they send in with it when they do their taxes, and then they just send a copy of the final judgment of adoption, and then they send, there's a letter that the CBC gives them that says there has been a special needs determination. It's the letter, it's the subsidy agreement. So it's the letter that tells them how much they're going to get every month. That letter has language on it that says that the child's been deemed to have special needs. Because, remember, the child can't get subsidy unless the child has been deemed to have special needs. So that's all you need to submit to get the full amount of the credit. So, if you have a family that tells you that and they tell them they need to go to a different accountant because that accountant doesn't know the adoption tax credit. It's even in the simple, you know, the IRS puts out directions to fill out all the forms. It's clearly in the directions. So the accountants that, you know, tell them that are not even reading the directions associated.
Do you guys want to go in the training room?
With the form.
Oh. Or what about that one? That one too?
So, oh. I think I recognize that voice, but I'm not going to call out that person. but we can hear you. And let me see. Let me just glance over the rule one more time and just make sure. Okay. Then the other thing that's in the rule that's interesting is that the adoption, that the assistance is, children are eligible for it even outside of Florida. So, you know, the subsidy should transfer with the child. It can also transfer with the child to a different family. It's complicated. You need to get your CBC involved. The family needs to contact the CBC before they, you know, to make all that happen. It cannot, however, and we just had this come up. I don't know if any of these attorneys are on the call, but we had recently an issue where a birth parent was readopting the child. And it's not, birth parents are not eligible for it. So it does stop in that scenario. But otherwise, it should go with the child. There's a case here that is pending, but it's a child that's seeking to be emancipated, and the parents are receiving subsidy, and I'm going to be curious, I don't know yet, and maybe one of you guys have had this come up, but I'm going to be curious to see what happens. She should be emancipated. She meets all the criteria under the statute. It's a clear grounds for emancipation. She's very mature and sophisticated and has clearly met all the requirements. It's going to be interesting to see how the department handles the subsidy piece when she's emancipated. Okay, but I want to make sure, because I said I was only going to talk for like 20 minutes and let you guys ask questions, and I have, of course, blabbered on for much longer than that. But so what questions do you guys have? Everyone's asleep.
Huh. I hear crickets. Any questions from anybody? Thank you, Mary Kay.
I have a question. I have a question. Regarding that college tuition, you were mentioning that if it's an adoption of an older child, it would be, at what point do you think it would be beneficial regarding a monthly stipend to put that towards the college subsidy?
Well, no, they're going to get both. So they get the college tuition and the monthly, absolutely. So they don't need to save for college because they're going to get college tuition. And then with the Pell Grant, they get their books paid. You know,